Welcome to the Fifth Estate. I'm Sally Warhaft, and it is such a pleasure to be with you. And an even bigger pleasure to welcome George Megalogenis and, our favourite Fifth Estate special commentator on the pandemic and other things. George, of course, is an author and journalist. His books include The Australian Moment, Australia's Second Chance, and The Football Solution, How Richmond's Premiership Can Save Australia. Hello, George. Welcome back.
How are you, Sally? It's been a long 6 months.
It sure has, and it has been 6 months. It was the 31st of March when you came into the Wheeler Centre to have a chat about the, I think we were 1 week into the first lockdown in Melbourne. It feels a bit like we've gone backwards since then because we were allowed to be in the studio that night, and now, of course, we're at our kitchen tables. Winter was coming. It's now past. How are you going, George? How have your days been?
So we're okay. I mean, I don't think you can say any more than okay. I think okay is sort of 6, 7 out of 10, when the range is probably minus 10 to maybe 8. But it's a bit of a grind, but we're safe, and I think that's probably the most important thing. As a citizen, and this is the, I always have to separate the journalist part of me from the citizen, I'm consuming more news in the first half of the day than I think that I have at any point in my career as a working journalist. So you have the computer on, you're looking at all the live feeds, you watch the Dan Andrews press conference. Part of you wonders how you'd go in that space yourself if you had to throw a question or two to somebody who's been going 82 days in a row delivering these sermons. And you're exhausted by midday. And it's very difficult to do any work, even though you're sort of literally as an author and as an observer trained for moments like this, trained for isolation. But it doesn't feel like isolation. It's a heavier experience than the normal working from home.
It really is. It is some sort of COVID exhaustion, and just about everybody speaks of it. I will be amazed if I see a great book, for example, that comes out of this pandemic about how you could focus your concentration. Being a writer, say, with all the time in the world to write, really, really challenging. When we met in March, I will quote you from that evening. You said, "The funny thing about this pandemic is it's the Spanish flu, the Great Depression, and World War II all wrapped into one." I'd like you to just reflect on that now, because it felt right at the time. And how are you thinking about it now?
Those three elements are still at play. But the pandemic is the thing that takes precedence. And so I think the difficulty one would have had juggling all those thoughts in March was not knowing how long and grinding a pandemic is, and how there is really no normal to look forward to or to even get your head around. So the working backwards, the analogy is the government shuts down the economy and only allows essential work to go ahead. That's the war element, the planned element of it. But the depression element is that a lot of people are forced to stay at home. So you've got high unemployment. During the Second World War, we had full employment. We literally went, once we went to a planned economy, we went to full employment overnight. Statistics are quite sharp from that era. You know, you had a 5, 6, 7, 8% unemployment rate into the first year or two of the Second World War, and it's an overhang from the depression. And then suddenly when Curtin flicks the switch to a planned economy, a war economy, all non-essential work closes down and women go into the munitions factories and all the guys are in the services. There was no unemployment. That's not this situation. Mm. This situation is more the depression style. Either people laid off, stood down, got an attachment to an employer, not working an hour, or having lost their job. In fact, fewer people have lost their jobs in an official sense, in a measured sense, than I would have predicted in March. I'm pleasantly surprised the unemployment rate has only got a 6 or a 7 in front of it, not a 10, 12 or 15, which is the situation in the US. But both those elements, the thing that takes precedence is the health crisis. And the health crisis is the thing that creates those two elements other elements?
We've played our advantages really well on the whole. Obviously, there is this ongoing situation in Melbourne.
In Melbourne.
But we chose well, didn't we? But we've done well. You know, we had the season going for us. We've got our health system and a continent. We haven't had to worry about massive things that have been problems elsewhere. But it feels lately, quite recently, like the thinking is getting cluttered again.
Yes, absolutely.
The great clarity that was there at the beginning of the pandemic from the leaders, both state and federal, it's just starting to feel a bit messy. Is that your reading?
Yeah, so I think we don't need to put a graph up. I think people can imagine the two curves. The first curve, which was rising quite dramatically in the second half of March, and the worry was because we were tracking, we were about a week or two behind the UK, and we already knew where the UK was when they didn't bend that curve. So they were already in sort of meltdown. We knew where the US was going. We'd seen what had happened in Italy. But we'd also seen the counterfactual, which was China, who bent the curve. Whether you believe all their data or not is sort of neither here nor there. They're able to suppress it. But they are suppressed with draconian measures. And I'm not sure that we understood what it would take to bend the curve properly in March. But through March and April, we're watching those numbers go up, 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 and then suddenly off it comes. The key decisions were the closing of the international borders, which was played to our natural advantage, and that the health system was geared up to handle the first wave of infections. So just working our way through it, March into April, there was a lot of fear around, but there was also a common purpose. And I think as we watched that number come down and then we realised where the rest of the world was. So we knew we had New Zealand to our east was obviously even better than we were. We looked around the world and we found about two or three countries that looked like us. South Korea, Taiwan, briefly Singapore, but then Singapore had a second wave. Do you remember Singapore had a second wave?
It was very similar to ours, to Victoria's.
Yeah, so it turns out now pretty much every country's had a second wave. But I think about a month ago when we were the first into the second wave, after we thought we dodged the worst of it, I think the narrative was getting very wobbly. Let's talk about the politics in a second, but let's think about where we were placed vis-a-vis the rest of the world. We were one of the winners and suddenly our name went across to the question mark category. Now, the Financial Times, and I used to follow their coronavirus tracker daily, and I'd plot us against the Greeks, against the South Koreans, against the Italians, against the Brits, against the Americans, and we were looking good up until the point that the Victorian thing started to get away. And the FT, the Financial Times, had for a long time on their dashboard, it had us as the example. We were able to keep deaths below 10 a day. At no point in the first wave did we lose more than 10 people in a single day. And that was their marker for our success. And then, of course, there was a couple of tragic days where the numbers were well over 10 and then our name came off. And I remember checking the dashboard the next day and obviously their numbers had updated. Australia was suddenly off that board and we were no longer held up as a... And I have to admit, as a sort of nerd as well as a citizen, that was quite a deflating moment. And that was around the time you knew we were going to go back to stage three and then eventually stage four. It was a horrible time. Horrible time. And now, of course, without sort of jumping to the end, because I don't want to call this thing as over, now we look at the bending of the second curve, and the second curve's bigger than the first curve, and obviously we've lost a lot of people the second time around. We now look good again, because we're able to get it under control a second time. So the way this virus has played out, everybody who opened up after they got smashed the first time around are now looking at draconian lockdowns in Europe again. So the Brits are not far away from locking down again. The French are trying to live with it, but they're going to have to lock down again. Don't know what's going to happen to the Italians. So the Spanish are in trouble again. And the Americans have never really had the end of their first wave. It's sort of a series of plateaus. It's sort of like a series of sort of reverse Mount Rushmores for them. 50,000, 100,000, 150,000, and now 200,000 dead. So I think we're about to put ourselves back into the ability to look at us vis-a-vis the rest of the world and say we're still doing all right. But it was, look, admittedly, it was very wobbly there for about a month or so. That day, and I think everybody in Australia will remember the day that Dan Andrews rocked up and he looked disheveled, he looked stressed, he looked wrung out, you know, the way Scott Morrison looked late March, early April.
The way I looked,
George. The way we all looked at the time. 725 cases in a single day.
It was an awful day.
And the question mark then was, as hard as we were going to lock down, was it too late? Because remember the simple thing about this virus, the 2 days before symptoms and the day of symptoms are your three maximum days when you're most infectious. So the virus has a 2 out of 3 chance when it's hooked into an individual of hopping to another individual without either of them knowing. And when you're at 725 cases, and they couldn't track any of them, they didn't know the source of any one of those infections. I'm glad we are where we are today. I mourn every single death, but I'm glad we are where we are today.
Yeah. It felt for a little while there, two things it felt. One, that it was out there. That was the only time in the pandemic where I really felt, gosh, I could get this thing anywhere, because it just felt like there was a little bit of it all around.
It was everywhere. It was everywhere. Although, weirdly.
Well, that the whole thing could really get away. So it's amazing, you know, good on Victoria. Amazing effort. Tell me what you think about the political response in terms of learning about the real world. Do you think that our leaders have are in touch with that in a way that they weren't?
Yeah, so I think the first wave story, and I know what we were discussing in March. My concern in March was that the thing governments, obviously led at that point by the federal government, because Scott Morrison was chair of the national cabinet, and he was the main person we were all going to. We weren't referring to the state premiers at this point. He was the main person we were going to for information about how our lives would change to deal with this crisis. I think in that first phase, you got a sense that he and his government were very quickly coming up to speed on what their responsibility was after they've asked us to shut down. So when you ask households to isolate from other households, when you ask workers to not go to work, when you ask others to try and work from home, and when you ask young families to school their kids at home, with no allowance for age or special needs or the like. At that point, I think they were very quickly coming up to speed on the complexity of the Australian society. And remember their initial steps, the first two steps were stimulus. So they were looking to provide some money but telling you couldn't go shopping. So what was the point of the stimulus? I think their brain was still thinking 2008 GFC. And remember around the middle and late March, Scott Morrison was referencing the GFC going, our package is more targeted and is not as big as Kevin's. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, I thought, mate, you haven't picked it yet. You don't understand what it is you're asking people of Australia to do. You're asking them to stay at home. You're basically putting the entire country on sick leave. So you have to give them full pay. Otherwise, if you don't give
I think he did that the day before we talked, actually.
Yeah.
It was in very late March, and there was
March 29.
Okay, we're on a track.
Yeah, the penny finally dropped with JobKeeper. And what JobKeeper did was reduce the risk that people, through no fault of their own, would take risks that they wouldn't normally take. Maybe go to work when you have a sniffle. Maybe forget to, even though you should have a mask on at some point, maybe forget to put it on, touch your face, all that sort of stuff. So those are the risks. Those are the risks, because this virus travels exponentially, those are the risks that are controllable from a government's perspective. And I think March 29, JobKeeper, you could feel the place starting to calm down through that first wave. What are the other lessons he's learnt? Remember, in March and into April, he's hoping this thing is over by now. He's hoping that whatever the new normal is, we would have found it by September. They could let JobKeeper go. They could return JobSeeker, which is the unemployment benefit. They could turn it back to sort of, you know, the austerity rate that it's been at for the last 30 years. And they assume that people can open up, but in a, what was the jargon, in a COVID-safe way. Mm. And remember, there's that big chart that came out in about May with the three steps, and there are about 50, it's like snakes and ladders, piece of paper that if you downloaded it and you blew it up on your computer, you still couldn't understand it, even if you took it line by line. They were pretty confident that having knocked it off the first time around, it wasn't going to come back in a way that would force a second lockdown. I think at that point, okay, what do you remember of Scott Morrison in May and June? He's back to politics again. He's got the Eden Monaro by-election. He's making announcements in a non-COVID space.
He's telling people to go to the football, isn't he? Was that the...
Yeah, I think
that was a little bit before.
Oh, that was a bit earlier. He wanted to go that one day to show that things weren't out of control and then realised that by the end of that day, Peter Dutton had tested positive and he might have it. So he wasn't worried about the football at that point. He was worried about whether his cabinet was infected. I think by May and the rest, and remember our mindset would have been we've dodged the first wave, we've bent the curve, the rest of the world is applauding us. We've got a whole lot of women in the world, the leader of Taiwan, Jacinda Ardern, we've got Angela Merkel, and we've got Scott Morrison. Right, so you know we've got six women plus a guy that doesn't quite fit, but there is this checkerboard of sort of elite responses to the pandemic, and then you've got a couple of bozos at the other end: Trump, Johnson. Johnson had caught it by this stage. The poor bloke went in and shook the hand of somebody who was infected. The bloke in Brazil, who's clearly got a death wish for his country. So we looked all right then, but the complexity of this virus. And the understanding, and this is the second level of understanding I think a coalition government has struggled with. So I know Industrial Relations Minister and the ACTU President have both tried to figure this out, and I know Greg Combe has been doing a bit of work as well. But the second level of complexity is the nature of work. So for people who were still working and reopening the economy and the difficulty that some people found once you'd open the economy again to do the right thing by the pandemic, to do the right thing by community health, which is as soon as you got your sniffle, to stay at home. That thing, it was probably hiding in plain sight because the ACT had been asking for pandemic leave the minute this thing started. But by May and June, as the second wave starts in Melbourne, we know that it's obviously hotel quarantine where the primary failure is, but the spread is not hotel quarantine. The spread are people with insecure work moving from aged care centre to aged care centre, security guards moving from household to household, all doing a perfectly lawful thing at the time, but unaware that once the virus is in them, that they had to shut down and they had to take... And you couldn't get everybody to do it unless you told them. And even then it was, and at that point it was too late. I think that level of complexity, which is the safety net, it's not the safety net at the meta level of JobKeeper. It is every little stitch in the safety net, the gaps that the virus is so, you know, fiendishly exploited. As soon as it gets into a nursing home, it's going to wipe out half the poor people in the aged care, and all the healthcare, all the aged care workers are going to get it. Then they're going to spread it to their families. And then if there's an Uber driver in that extended family, they're going to spread it. And then if there's somebody in logistics that's moving medical supplies, they're going to spread it. If somebody's working in an abattoir, they're going to spread it. If somebody's driving a truck for Coles, they're going to spread it. It was so, and it happened so fast that I think it broke national unity at the political level. At the national cabinet level, you could see the shifting and the blame gaming. Firstly, everybody's
felt
all
very isolating here, didn't it? It felt very isolating.
So again,
all of a sudden in Victoria, like the drag on the ticket, you know, where the place bringing the rest of the nation down.
We stuffed it up for everyone. Yeah. Yeah, and of course, every one of us.
And no real sense of a prime ministerial taking care of you know, there was one remark about, you know, we're all Victorians now or we're all Melburnians now or something. But since then it has felt like we've just been locked out, not locked in.
Trying to remember the sequencing. Who blamed first? I reckon there was a period of about 3 or 4 days where both Morrison and Andrews lost their cool. And Daniel Andrews is a bit more passive-aggressive than Morrison. Once Morrison decides to turn it up, he does go all the way up to 11. So it was community transmission. And remember, he was doing the Melbourne-Sydney thing. So the New South Wales response in terms of contact tracing is the gold standard. what are you Melburnians up to? Hotel quarantine fiasco, you know, you start to sound like a shock jock. We offered you the troops. I'm not sure how the troops would have made any difference. Every state used security guards at some level, and we now know that some security guards in New South Wales had taken the virus out of quarantine, out of hotel quarantine and spread it. New South Wales, were they lucky? Was there contact tracing? You'll never be able to unpack that particular side of it. But then do you remember once it started racing through nursing homes in Victoria, Dan Andrews pushed straight back and he said, and you remember three or four press conferences in a row, he kept dropping it in, it's a federal responsibility, it's a Commonwealth responsibility, it's a Commonwealth responsibility. And, you know, he's like a six-year-old just sort of nagging you. Now, I want that chocolate. But it's not I want the chocolate. It is I'm coming after you. And then there was a truce between the two of them, but it was too late. You and I felt this, Sally, and I'm sure every Melbournean felt it. At some point, we all had it, right? And we couldn't interact with any other Australian for 3 to 6 weeks, 3 to 6 months. Who knew, right, at that point? Who knew? And all the state borders went back up again. Remember, a lot of the border restrictions between states and territories were being eased the middle of the year, and then before you knew it, we're out on our own.
George, what is all this going to mean for the future coming out of this, particularly for the economic path? And, you know, we have to put a few assumptions into you know, Victoria comes out of this well, and that somehow we can reach this, I can't stand this phrase, but this COVID normal that everybody else in Australia seems to be living in. And what does it mean that Victoria has had this experience for the rest of the country coming out of it? And what's our prognosis as a nation?
So health part first. So the fact that Victoria's had a second wave and they've been able to flatten the curve a second time has probably told health experts around the country that we have to shoot for as close as possible to suppression, sort of a very aggressive suppression is the term they use. We can't get elimination, but we have to step up the things that made Victoria beat it the second time around. And that means we'll be wearing these things for the rest of the year across the country. I think sooner or later the mask mandate when you're out on public transport, when you're out in the open, these are things that are probably part and parcel of living with the virus until we get a vaccine or until it burns itself out. Now, there is a 1 in 10 chance. Next year at some point the virus has just sort of done its worst and burns itself out. Some of the previous coronaviruses have, after they've killed more people, not in a global sense, but you know, a higher death rate per virus, they've just burnt themselves out. We haven't found vaccines for them.
As this happens, though, of course, the money is going to run out, isn't it? That JobKeeper supplement and the what does that mean?
Yeah, so the economic question is an interesting one now. You know, the number, loosely the number, is Victoria's 25% of the national economy. The September quarter, having just had a shocking, you know, historic contraction in the economy in the June quarter, which sort of doesn't really, that contraction doesn't really matter if at the other end everything can return to normal. It doesn't matter if you have a couple of bad quarters. So as individuals, when we take a week off work, as long as there's still cash in the bank, it doesn't matter. Conceptually, it doesn't matter if you have a couple of bad quarters. It's just what's there at the other side. Can everybody return to work? Now, some businesses are in a zombie state now, been propped up by government assistance. They probably won't be there at the other side. We still can't have a read, and this is where Victoria is going to complicate things for the nation. Consumers will probably be a bit more wary. So some of the data that I've been tracking is, you know, your willingness to go to use public transport again. Half the country still doesn't want to get on public transport again. And This is one of those stats that in obviously in March you ask them, nobody wants to go on it, and then 30% want to start using it by about May and June, and then it sort of taps out at about 50% and the other half of the country doesn't want to use it. It's like most things, it's just sort of leveled off. What Victoria has done is taken the air out of, you know, that incremental recovery we had in the middle of the year.
And the joy out of the reemergence.
Yeah, and I think it's made it more difficult. It's made it more difficult for leaders to be able to get people to readjust their expectations, because we could have come out of this with a deep recession, but everybody in a position to get on with their lives. But you know, we've all taken a haircut, although literally we haven't had a haircut for 6 months in Victoria, which is a different issue. But you know what I mean? Like you've taken this hit to your lifestyle, you've taken this hit to your work life and your social life, but it's over now and things will change, but we'll still be able to grow from here on in off a much lower base. We don't have that option now. It's a shame. WA is about the only state that looks like a state would look like if that's what the country would have looked like if we'd landed perfectly in April and never got out again. Now, you know, Dictator Dan and all that sort of stuff, all those memes about how he's horribly responsible. I'm much more forgiving than most. And you might ask me why I'm more forgiving of Victoria's plight than not. But WA is almost at the position where all the jobs that lost have come back, and now they're in a shortages position in some parts. And now this is phase two. So this is, you know, in terms of what you learn from this thing, because our international borders closed, WA is already bumping up against the problem that we have next year, which is we can't return to the Australian normal, which is this open country that basically sources two-thirds of its population growth overseas. So that country can't come back. Even if we're all in a WA position 6 months from now, and, you know, you could have your theatres open again with social distancing, you can go to the movies again,
the Wheeler Centre,
the opera, we could have writers' festivals again, we could go to the MCG, we could do all that, and Wheeler Centre could light up again, we could do all that stuff. But the next constraint, whilst the virus is still ripping around the globe, is that we're stuck with who we've got now. And I don't mean in terms of, you know, who's the next person coming in is better than the one who's already here. When you're stuck at 25 million and the population doesn't grow for a year or two, aging accelerates within your country. The other thing is within your country you get a lot of people being displaced. So Melburnians may want to head for the regions. People may all want to move to WA. Weirdly, it feels like the 1890s when I just look at how some of the data might be tracking. Remember, one of the things after Marvellous Melbourne ended its run was 50,000 people left. Most of them went to the WA goldfields. A few came back hungrier than they left. But in the interim, of course, having put WA in a position to vote for Federation, you had this sort of progressive wave go east. You had football, west. You had football go west. Something crazily similar might happen in the next year or so, where people leave the capitals for the regions, people from the regions are moving to other parts of the country. That displacement story is quite a fascinating story for me, but it's still stressful for a country because you can't manage it, because you can't manage the individual choices at that point. Again, whilst this virus is ripping around, our best case scenario is still very complicated.
So what should we be doing? What are the ideas that should be being discussed at the moment about how we could come out of this with some real creativity, perhaps, even some real thinking behind it?
Yeah, I'm looking at four spots at the moment. I'll use that word, scale up. Remember Scott Morrison kept talking about things being scalable and was an awful word earlier in the year?
Yeah, it still is an awful word, isn't it? But we know what you mean.
Yeah, but if you think about how would you live with this thing, assuming the virus has still got another year to rip around the globe, and even if you were to get a miracle cure, you know, in time for Donald Trump to be re-elected, sorry, it's a doomsday scenario, but you know what I mean? Like even if you got the miracle cure this year, it'd still take about 6 to 12 months to inoculate the globe. And then you're not sure how long that thing holds, and it may recognize that it's been headed off the past by technology and it might mutate, come again. So in that world, what's your first priority as a society? And that is to make sure that your health system is bulletproof. So that means you scale up in a way that you probably you would only do in a war. So this go back to the war analogy. So the health system probably needs to be much stronger than it is now. We look at it and we think it's done well. Yes, it's done well to head off the threat, but it's not in a position to allow us to live a theoretically safe life from here on, to be able to enjoy some of the things we want to enjoy again. And remember, it's very difficult to keep a lid on a country for as long as we've done. I think Victorians have been magnificent in their patience, but you couldn't go into a third lockdown, could you? Another state... No, you couldn't do it. But you wouldn't do it.
No.
Which is why you have to think about making your health system bulletproof. The second part, and this is even harder, is aged care. I'd be looking really quickly if I was a federal government at just tearing up the model that they've got now, because it kills people and it costs too much anyway. In a sense, what the government is doing is handing over money to private providers whose profit incentive is still going to get people killed. And I don't mean that in a, you know, evil capitalism. I mean the incentives are wrong. This is an area of public health that the government should be in charge of. You can't get the market to better allocate death.
Mm.
So that's the second thing you'd be doing. And these things are real emergency measures, but once you've baked them in, you've created a permanent shift in your society and your economy. Then the next one, and you should be doing this in parallel if your governments, federal and state, states will be thinking more about this one, how to make schools safe. Because we're not going to have, I can guarantee you, regardless of where the virus is, next year no premier is going to eyeball working families or laid off families or furloughed families or whatever phrase you use and say, by the way, you're going to teach your kids for another year at home. That's not going to happen. There'll be no permission for that. So they need to be working now to figure out how to make schools safe. So how to make and this isn't world class, right? This is beyond world class. This is safe. Safe health system, safe aged care system, safe education system. The activation of governments to do that is a project that I still don't think our leaders will be able to conceptualise yet. I think they kind of know they've been dragged towards it. We don't have a public language around it. So
these, of course, are the most basic elements of of governance, aren't they? They're mostly
human survival, and they are state. Yeah, we're sort of alluding to the Federation earlier. So one of the most interesting things about phase one of the lockdown was how Morrison read the National Cabinet well enough to walk out with them and decide to be their chair. When the second wave came and he got into blame game with Daniel Andrews, you very quickly realised that the premiers and the chief ministers in the end don't trust him. And the conversations they've had with each other behind closed doors, and some of them have spilled out, you know, phoning premiers and tell them to do this and tell them to do that, I think he's read the play badly. And I think he knew that, which is why the last couple of weeks he sort of retreated against how the news poll number would improve for him. He knew there was a news poll in the field. And his numbers did improve once he, zipped it. But no premier or chief minister, having exercised the emergency powers they've had to exercise in health, education and in police, remember it's also about police because that's the enforcement part of whatever stage lockdown you're in, they're not going to let that go easily. But how do you pay for it? The Commonwealth is still the one holding the credit card. So this entire federal relationship, who runs the country, who does what, who's responsible for what, and who pays for it. All these debates are going to be had, and they're going to be epic debates. They're not little debates. Because, again, remember what the virus is doing to us. The virus is forcing us to prioritise health over everything else.
Mm.
And because it's a silent enemy and it's a vicious one, it's not like, you know, the Germans are bombing us, let's innovate and figure out how to shoot a plane out of the sky. These are things that you can mechanically see the adaptation steps. These adaptation steps, because it's a silent enemy, you almost have to overreach and then you're not even confident that you'll win.
So who's going to be the really biggest losers, do you think, in this in the coming years?
Unfortunately, I think it's old people. Older Australians. So older Australians have just had, you know, the long party's obviously ended for them, but this other bit to it now, because the social contract has been renegotiated, even though we're prioritising their health over everyone else. Older people are sensing a vulnerability in Australia that they haven't sensed before. They've been able to swing elections consistently. Some of their trivial wants have been satisfied by government over, you know, younger people over home. You know, they get to keep their investment properties and all the other stuff. I think they're the big losers because in a structural sense, it's not possible to recreate the windfall that they enjoyed up until 2019, because now there's the existential threat to their very existence that this virus presents. And as we sort of try to learn to live with it, and as we have all of these other problems which we're not attending to at the moment, we have to try and fix, politics is going to have to shift at some point back to younger people. Now, that doesn't mean younger people will swing elections, but politics is going to have to shift to them anyway because you can't hold your society together. So I'd say straight up, older people are the big losers. In a power sense, so going back to the Federation thing, I think the Prime Minister will look back at 2019 as being the peak of the centralisation of power in Australia, and from here on we're all going to know who our premiers and chief ministers are across all jurisdictions. And I think future prime ministers are going to have to figure out that relationship. They're going to have to be versions of Bob Hawke in the 21st century, but without the levers that Bob Hawke had. So that's a change. So the loser, in a sense, is, and I don't think this is a bad thing, the loser, in a sense, is the Commonwealth. Now, in terms of the states and territories and the cities versus the regions, this is still a big question mark to me. At first blush, and I still think this is how it's going to play out in the long run, I think Melbourne and Sydney are going to pull rank on the rest of the country. And unfortunately, when I say older people are the losers, I think the regions are going to be the losers in when we're isolating from the rest of the world. Because remember, even if people are leaving Melbourne and Sydney for the regions, they're going to hoard the talent eventually because that's where all the jobs will be. And Daniel Andrews and Gladys Berejiklian, if they both sort of survive this phase, I'm not sure that Daniel Andrews wants to be premier for 10 years, but let's say the two of them emerge as, you know, the theoretical sort of 21st century leader role models in Australia. They're going to be doing things on their own behalf, and the rest of the country may or may not fit with their plans. And think about it. We're, in a sense, what we're doing is taking the country back to the original power struggle between those two cities. We're sort of back to the 1880s. It's a, as a Melburnian, obviously I was depressed about the second lockdown, but also as a historian, and I don't want to oversell my reading of history, but the pattern I see is the pattern that at first blush seemed to be the pattern at the beginning of this. These two cities are going to figure this out before everybody else does, and they're not going to give up the insight that they just that's just been revealed to them, is that they can run the country. And they've been disenfranchised politically for a long time, and they may not decide a federal election, but again, it may not matter. By the way, what happened in the US, right? New York, California. Different curves, but essentially both those governors and both those, and the mayor of New York especially, but basically said to the federal government, you're not going to help us. Well, we're 84, whatever share of their national economy they were, they've decided, well, we're going to run our own show.
We go our own way.
Mm. Yeah.
Jobs of the, near to middle future. You've talked about
an awful one,
is an awful one. I mean, but is it obvious that they're going to be in health, they're going to be in education, these essential, and all these workers. It's basically the people that have got permits at the moment to go and do their work are going to be where the job growth is.
Yeah, I think so. And job growth. Conceptually, it's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because we're going to be looking at...
It sounds fantasy at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're looking at permanently elevated unemployment because some sectors of the economy are still going to be shut down. But, I think the culture side, and I haven't mentioned the culture side yet, I think the culture, arts, recreation sport, I think they're still going to have to figure out a way to go back to front and centre of the national conversation. I think one of the things that will exhaust us by the end of this year are the daily briefings from politicians. Because this, I think one of the reasons why this has been
a mistake.
I think it helps the leaders to turn up every day, because I think at that point they understand they're also processing, they're human beings, so they're also processing the enormity of the challenge. I would not want any of those jobs. You couldn't do it. It's bad enough being a helpless citizen in this thing. I'd hate to be the person making the decisions. And you can see it's written on their face. Andrews is the first one who's passed through whatever fog you pass through, and this happens, presumably this happens in war, where you no longer care about politics. And he says it, and I know he means it, because in his head, because he's had to go to a second lockdown for the state and especially the city, he knows that there's no third chance. So he's singular focus, and he tells you this every day, but he needs to turn up every day to remind him. So the day he goes back to politics, you'd almost want a leadership spell at the moment if the virus is still out there. You need to get rid of him. But I think he understands that, which is why turning up every day matters. Although it does on one level, I have to ask the question, this is sort of an internal sort of business of government question, how much time is it taking for him to get his head around the presentation, and is there a guy left at the other end who can continue to run the state and make other decisions at the end of the day? I find even I love this format, I love this conversation we're having. When the camera turns off at the end of this thing, the letdown on something, just for the two of us, is exhausting. Yes, you just run around like a crazy person in the house for the next hour trying to get your head back. You're the leader.
It's really
you've
different.
You've done 82 briefings in a row of an hour, hour and a half at length, exhausting every question in the room. And for the first two-thirds of the appearance, you know, the virus is almost overrun you anyway, and you're
and it's possibly the simplest period of the day when you're not actually making the really big crucial decisions, when you're up there, whatever decisions are going to be released have already been made.
Remember when Scott Morrison was rolling out of those national cabinet meetings and then doing the press conference on a Thursday night or something, some random hour about 10:30, I think that's sort of moment when the public registered the peak stress. And obviously what he's done is sort of moved programming to the Friday afternoon briefing for National Cabinet. But even then, I still can't see how that was functional for him as a human being. At the end of that Friday, you've made all the decisions through the week, and then suddenly you've got to front and calm the population down. And you can't hide the stress. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary times for each and every one of them. And I've been talking to some former leaders, by the way, on this, and they all just shake their heads. They wouldn't want these jobs. I mean, they, you know, moss to a flame. These are power junkies. They would obviously step up. But there's one I was talking to in particular, we're talking about Andrew's position, and there's no good outcome for him, because this is going to kill him in a spiritual sense. Whether it kills him in a political sense is sort of off the point. And this person made this other observation: if you're in the opposition shoes, what game would you be playing? Okay, attack, attack, attack. What happens if the thing got out again and you got to be the government? Do you really want the job on those terms? This is quite an interesting conversation I've had with one person in particular, and I hadn't thought of it quite in that particular dynamic. Every player in the system almost has to check themselves before they. Because the consequences.
A lot of them aren't.
I mean,
I guess, you know, in a state like Victoria, it's a fixed term, so everybody knows there's a couple
and
of.
And this
years.
Bloke, by the way, this bloke wasn't necessarily a Labor or Liberal person. This bloke just understood the way the show runs, and he saw no upside for anyone.
It's interesting. I can't think of anywhere in the world actually where there's been an election that's resulted in a massive change of direction in how you think about that. And in fact, the US election, of course, looms as the,
That's a different game though, isn't it? I mean, COVID is front and centre in a way, but that game, so the choice for the American people is, do they want to run the world again? Do they want to be, you know, pre-Trump America, or are they sort of committed to this polarisation, and do we watch an empire collapse in real time? So it's a consequential election, but every other. So we've had a by-election, a federal by-election in Eden Monaro, score draw, basically no change. So Labor held onto that seat. It's quite unusual that Labor could hold that seat when the Prime Minister's approval rating was in the high 60s at the time. Northern Territory, Labor's re-elected with a majority. Queensland's coming, ACT's coming, WA's around the corner, and there's a federal election maybe second half next year or maybe 2022. It's possible that this is a bit like 2001. Nothing happens at an election. That the population registers the shock as a shock that governments in the end didn't bring on. And I don't want to rock the boat as a voter. So change is actually quite risky. And I think this is what this other chap was referring to from the Victorian opposition perspective. Not that do you want power, they would want power, but do you understand the consequences of getting it when your entry into power is just whinge, you know, attack, and then you've got this heavy responsibility. Does a voter want to take that risk? It's quite an interesting, and it doesn't happen often. So 2001, in and around that election, I remember I covered it, sweated the detail. I was doing daily reality check columns for The Australian and sweated the detail booth by booth, all that sort of stuff. There were swings to sitting members regardless of party across the board. Wayne Swan got a swing to him in Lilly, in Brisbane, at the same time that John Howard was sending troops off to Afghanistan to fight the good war, straight after September 11. In the end, Tampa didn't matter that much. Basically, what the people of Australia said in that election was, and they were thinking local, by the way. They weren't thinking of changing the government. They weren't actually thinking of even changing their local member. So people with a Labor member weren't thinking of switching to a coalition member, you know, to take out extra insurance because you thought the government was going to re-elect it. They just didn't want to change anything. And that may be what we're seeing this year. But next year, if the unemployment rate's at 10 and the government is sort of exhausted, and we didn't mention earlier, we were sort of alluding to the JobKeeper issue because we're obviously stepping down from that sort of maximum support to, you're kind of on your own now. Is the economy ready to function normally without government support? Well, if you're asking people at the same time to maintain social distance and to have hand hygiene and you can't do this and you can't do that, well, I still think you have to be shoveling the sort of money into people's pockets that reduce the risk of them as individuals making a decision that's not in the interest of community health.
How long can an economy like Australia's do that?
Isn't this the experiment? So I think, obviously, the Americans couldn't even do it for a week. New Yorkers could do it, but Americans couldn't do it because in their system there was the incentive, you know, let's open by Easter, don't wear a mask, then Black Lives Matter. So basically a lot of things were going on at the same time in the US.
The politics.
Yeah. So politics is there, but people wanted to get out and express themselves. They went stir crazy really, really quickly. We're Australians, so we kind of do stir crazy, but if the rules say do something, because remember there's a...
We're very obedient. Yeah. It's that John Hurst,
John was always
incredibly
always
obedient.
Right about this, and reinforced by successive waves of assisted passage migration. I always look at pretty much every migrant wave has a version of the convict understanding of power here, which is, you brought me out here. If you're a free migrant, you chose to come out here, but the government, in a sense, has invited you here, and you're not going to blow the place up once you get here. So we're obedient. So it's possible we could go longer than others.
Is the happy ending, if there could possibly be one, down the track, whether it's towards the end of next year or probably later, I would imagine, when international borders open up again, that, you know, we have a flood of the students, the international students come back, and people from around the world look at Australia, the relative success, our newly being, you know, built, improved upon world-class health infrastructure that you spoke of at the beginning, and our wonderful, perfect, safe schools. Is that the road out? Is it when those borders open?
Okay. So, yeah, we should – it's probably a good way to frame it. So what would be the best-case scenario for us, assuming a worst-case global scenario, which is the virus is still with us? So the best-case scenario, and we haven't talked much about universities, but – the best case scenario for us is that the world recognises us as a safe haven, and that we're able to take advantage of that in the areas that it matters most, and that is to get a whole lot of young people to want to move here and settle, and we get them through unis. And the thing I didn't mention earlier is to be able to do something like that, get you scale up your health, your bulletproof health, education, aged care. It also means that you have to think that your quarantine facilities are built to a particular scale that is not, so it's not a couple of crappy hotels in the city in each CBD across the country.
Mm.
It is, you know, big parts of the Northern Territory like they did with the first wave. Remember, the people coming back from Wuhan went to Christmas Island.
We should be able to do that here. We really should be able to do that here.
Yeah, but do you know what?
We've got the space.
Yeah. When we did that, it felt like we were racialising the virus, and then the government didn't do it again. So if the government had decided, hey, that worked. And I remember at the time the people that came out of that 14-day isolation were grateful. There was no, they didn't feel victimised. That sort of Andrew Bolt level people might have thought, the Chinese, of course, we put them where we put the refugees or wherever on Christmas Island. No, if we took the first lesson out of that, which was, okay, so we still want people to be able to at least come home.
Well, if we'd shut the border with America then and been treating
that's a big one, of course. But living with this thing means the borders are managed. And hang on a minute, I've just remembered, the federal government has been branding on border control ever since we were kids, right?
Mm.
Well, since 2001. But they can't do this. They can't think about this, because to be able to think about this, you have to accept the responsibility that the reason why you're doing this is not to keep the virus out, is to let people in.
Mm.
And I think conceptually they haven't got their head around the idea of, if we can prove that we've got a world-class health response, then, you know, the aspirational families of the world are going to want to send their kids here to be educated and to live. And we're a migrant nation, so we're going to have to figure out how to do that sooner or later. There's a second part to it, which is tourism, and that's very difficult. That's a different one. So Alan Joyce may not be able to...
Let's talk about the universities. Let's go back. I don't want to skip discussing the universities, because they're crucial to coming out of this, and I mean, they've had an appalling pandemic. I mean, obviously, their biggest source of research revenue locked out, and a government program, you know, that was announced where arts degrees, the kind of degree we're going to need people doing arts degrees and thinking things through and so on, but that's taken a real hit. So what's going to be the role of universities in this?
Look, I hope, I'll try to be as generous as possible. I hope that the government sees what it thinks it's doing, understands that the consequences are much worse than they've calculated, and then does a U-turn. Because the idea that somehow you'd separate your universities and make them take this shock, so you wouldn't ask a household to take the shock to the extent that they've asked universities. You know, they've changed the rules three times for JobKeeper so they wouldn't qualify. So suddenly you get a prime minister saying, I want to save every job, I want to open the economy up as quickly as possible, but by the way, I want to trash out tertiary institution, which is, depending on which year you count it, is either the third or fourth largest exporter. Conceptually, he wouldn't tell Gina Rinehart he wants to shut down the mines tomorrow, because she'd say, well, what about all that export earnings? What about our place in the world? And he'd say, sure, I would never think to do that. but he'd look at a VC, a vice chancellor, and say, oh, by the way, I want you to, you know, I want you to fund some savings. I want you to let some people go. The party's over. You have to start thinking about domestic only. No. You don't do that as a country. I would hope that they've sort of muddled in this partly through exhaustion and partly through, you know, some microaggressions from their ideology, and then realise that this is not in the national interest. And then at some point, Robert Menzies' hand is reaching out from the grave, grabs one of them by the collar and says, hang on a minute, I spent 20 years of my public life trying to build universities and sort of educate Australians and sort of make us a clever country. And then every prime minister that followed me has had their version of that story. Gough with free education, Fraser even, although he sort of nobbled that, Hawke with a clever country, Keating. Everybody wanted to lift Australia's horizon. Why do we suddenly get so overwhelmed by a pandemic that we want to dumb the country down? But I still don't think it's an active choice they've made. I think it's a passive choice they've made. I think it's too hard for them. I think that particular, we're talking earlier about understanding the many layers of what holds, you know, Australian society and what holds us together. I think they misunderstand the vulnerability if you pull out a strut from any sector. So if you don't treat every sector on equal terms, which is I'm asking you to adjust to deal with this health pandemic, and here's what I'm doing to make sure that you don't, that you're still there at the other side. They obviously haven't treated universities that way. But again, I think the problem is the opportunity. It's staring us in the face. The opportunity is, so neither the British or the American campus is going to be able to take students in there when our first semester 2021 starts. We're going to be able to do it. And look, there's obviously a geopolitical issue because the relationship with China is a bit scratchy at the moment, but I still don't see why we wouldn't want Chinese students.
Mm.
I still don't see why we wouldn't want Indian
students.
It
does seem like a...
And by the way, so one quick thought, and I'm trying to incentivize Scott Morrison here. He'd look at all the property that the vice chancellors have built up in the names of their sandstone universities. Well, convert some of them to quarantine facilities in the short term and make sure you take the rap for bringing the students on shore. There are other ways to think through these problems.
Yes. That is a bit of light, isn't it? The other big light, of course, is Richmond doing so well. And I'm just hoping that when they bring the premiership home to Melbourne, where it belongs, that you can write a new edition of the book, of course, which, you know, how Richmond Premiership can, well, save the world. And you know, given the year Richmond has had, it can reflect the country in some way. But it's a good read for anybody that hasn't read the Football Solution. It's the most beautiful local history, as well as other things. It's not just about football. George, before I thank you, I just a couple of things. This is the last Fifth Estate for the year. I promise we will be back next year, and I can't wait. Mostly the reason why we're putting it aside a little early this year is that I've been working on a fantastic new project for the Wheeler Centre, an audio podcast that is looking at the human response in a really deep way to this pandemic, and it will be out fairly soon. So get on the audio feed at the Wheeler Centre website, and you'll be alerted when that begins. And I'm really, really excited about it. And George, I'm really thrilled you could be the guest, our final guest this year. You always are, but usually the tradition is it's a wrap of the year where we look at this and that and the other. But you opened the pandemic year, and we're really thrilled you could come back to close it. I want to thank Veronica Sullivan, John Boyd Davidson, Jose Evelyn, and Cara Llewellyn, and everyone at the Wheeler Centre especially the tech people. I've named a couple of them there because it's amazing what they've done to be able to move things online. I want to remind everyone about the Wheeler Centre archive. It's just amazing. Go back and have a look at George's and my conversation from March 31st. He's not quite Nostradamus, but I'll tell you what, it was pretty impressive, George. So I want to thank everyone for joining in on these online events, Wheeler Centre website, and for being with us tonight. And I will see you really soon. Thank you, George.
Thanks again,
thank you
Sally.
So much. Take care.
You too.
I did miss being in the room with you a lot, but it's just great to see you. And football next year.
Yeah,
I hope.
No, we'll be there.
Take care, won't
we'll
you?
We'll be back at the Wheeler Centre and back at the MCG. Yeah. In that order.
And for everybody out there too, take care and see you later.